Okay. Anything preliminary or questions? All right. Last time we talked about vicarious liability and sort of finished up with the concept of negligence. Today we make the transition to talk about strict liability. And again, we're looking at a different way to achieve the same end, namely the plaintiff wants to establish that the defendant breached a duty of care, and obviously one way to do that is to show the defendant's negligence caused the plaintiff's injury. But as an alternative to that, the plaintiff may want to see if there's a way to establish liability based on strict liability. So I start with this sort of odd case, Helling versus Carey, because it helps to illustrate the difference between thinking about a case in terms of negligence as distinguished from thinking about it in terms of strict liability. And as we'll see, particularly looking at the concurring opinion, it's not always easy to figure out exactly what the judges who joined the concurring opinion are thinking. But their confusion may help us think more clearly about what we're doing. Mr. Muchow, how do you say, is that how you say? Tell us about Helling versus Carey. Okay, so she starts seeing the doctor in 1959, and it's 9 years before they finally give her the test that diagnoses her glaucoma, and because of the delay, she's unable to avoid the consequences of glaucoma, which are this sort of tunnel vision where she can see something, but it's like having a little light that you're shining around. Okay, so she files a claim against the doctor alleging that he was negligent. What happens when the case goes to trial? Okay, and before we get to that point, let's follow what happened in terms of the plaintiff's approach at trial. What's the plaintiff asking the trial judge to do, and what's the trial judge's reaction to the plaintiff's request? Or was proximately caused by the defendant's negligence. How does she propose to show that the defendant was negligent? Or how does she want the jury to reach the conclusion that the defendant was negligent? Okay, that essentially it was a simple test, and it's something she should have been given this test earlier. And she wants the jury to be able to find that their failure to give this test was negligent. What's the defendant's argument when the plaintiff puts it in those terms? The defendant claims at trial, what? Actually, you're getting to the merits of it. The defendant's, we're talking about what the standard is. The defendant says the question before the House is not what the jury thinks. The question before the House is, what's wrong with the way the plaintiff just was arguing that a reasonable person wouldn't have done that, would have given her the test sooner? The defendant says that's not what medical malpractice cases are all about. Medical malpractice cases depend on their what? Not so much intentionally, but how do we judge whether somebody has committed malpractice or not? Is there any way? Okay, but in a case like that, how do we know whether somebody is negligent? Do we simply ask the jurors, would you have given this person a glaucoma test? The defendant says, no, that's not the way we do it. Before you can hold me, the defendant, liable for negligence, you've got to find what? Or what does the jury need to hear, Mr. Inouye? According to whom? You know, according to the profession. In other words, the debate we're having at trial is over the role of the profession in setting the standard of care. And the doctor claims at trial, I answer to my professional colleagues. If they say to give a pressure test before the age of 40, I am obligated to follow the standard of care and give a pressure test. But if the profession, through its processes, has reached the conclusion that it's not advisable to give a test to anyone under the age of 40, I am not obligated. Who am I, in effect, mere doctor that I am, to question the wisdom of the profession as a whole? What does the trial judge do in response to that claim that the defendant is only held to the standard that has been established by the profession? What's the trial judge's response to that? Yeah. Trial judge then instructs the jury, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, if you find that the doctor, the defendant in this case, didn't live up to the standard of the profession, you may find the defendant negligent. What does the plaintiff want, by contrast? How does the plaintiff want the trial judge to instruct the jury? Okay, if you, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, think the profession has acted negligently, you may then find this doctor negligent. By what authority could a trial judge hold the profession to a higher standard? Okay, but legally speaking, by what authority? Where would a trial judge find approval for rejecting the standard adopted by the profession? Somebody's done it before. Somebody said a whole calling may lag behind the standard of reasonable care. However persuasive be its usages, who did that? Who's from which gospel am I now quoting here, Mr. Liebman? Yeah, it's Learned Hand T.J. Hooper case. He says, look, we're the boss here. You're not the boss of me, says T.J. Hooper with respect to tugboats. And so similarly, the plaintiff says, why should doctors be treated any differently from tugboat operators? Sure, the testimony of other doctors is relevant, maybe persuasive, but we can't roll over and play dead just because this profession hasn't recognized the value of giving a pressure test to people regardless how old they are. Again, as you said, the trial judge said ixnay on that and denied the plaintiff the requested instruction, and now the plaintiff's appealing to the Washington Supreme Court. What does the Washington Supreme Court say about whether the plaintiff was entitled to an instruction that would allow the jury, in effect, to overrule the practices adopted by the specialty of ophthalmology and impose a higher standard? What does the Washington Supreme Court say, the majority opinion, say about that? Even though the ophthalmologists say otherwise? Yeah. Tugboat operators, ophthalmologists, same, in effect, says the majority. We, in the end, get to make that call. Now, assuming we've got a problem with the jury instruction, that the plaintiff was entitled to a better jury instruction than she got, and the court now says, here's the kind of instruction that should have been given, what would be our remedy for that error? How would we fix that? Thinking sort of from our what we know about procedure. You give a wrong jury instruction, jury returns a verdict, losing party appeals to the higher court says, appealing party, you're right, this was a bad instruction, here's the instruction that should have been given. Then what? What would we ordinarily do? Mr. Edwards? Yeah, ordinarily we'd say, do over. Take a mulligan on this one here. And we'll have another trial in which the correct instruction is given. Plaintiff gets to invite the jury, and presumably at that point the defendant, the doctor, would be able to now go back to the jury and say, here's why we don't give a pressure test to people under the age of 40. And there may be perfectly good reasons why the profession of ophthalmology decided it didn't need to be done for people under the age of 40. Remember, that was not the question before the House at the trial of the case. The issue, as the trial judge framed it, as the evidence was taken and as the argument was made to the jury, the question was, did this doctor meet the standard of the profession? Everybody assumed that was the name of the game. The plaintiff didn't like them apples, wanted a different rule, but that's the judge said, okay, this is the way the game's going to be played. So it's not the doctor's job to explain or justify the profession standard. It was the doctor's job merely to show, here's what the standard is, I was in compliance with it. But that's not what happened here with the Washington Supreme Court. Obviously, the Washington Supreme Court did not return this to the trial court to now have the jury decide whether a reasonable person would have given a pressure test to put the practice of ophthalmology under the microscope, so to speak, and allow the jury to pass judgment on whether they did right or wrong. What does the Washington Supreme Court do with this case? Okay, they say the doctor here was negligent, period, end of discussion. We do need, of course, a jury to calculate the damages, but there's no need for a jury to consider whether or not this doctor was negligent. We know he was. And how do they know the doctor was negligent? How do they reach that conclusion? On what basis are they so sure the doctor was negligent, Ms. Huckert? Well, more than being injured, though, that doesn't by itself establish negligence, does it? What about her injury just from when you read the facts? Seems to you like this, I don't understand why the doctors didn't figure this out. Right, but it's her care that we infer, in effect, was negligent. Yes, ma'am, I don't see her. There it is, Ms. Hales, sorry. Okay, it took him over 10 years, but the court also makes reference to Mr. Hall. Yeah, it was. They essentially, again, our old friend Lord in Hand comes back to help us or haunt us, as the case may be, in the form of this comparison. The burden was slight. You know, it was just this easily given test. The potential benefit, even if it only happens one in 25,000 cases, if out of 25,000 people, one of them can be spared the consequences of glaucoma, well, that would make a reasonable person willing to give a pressure test. Mr. Johnson? Well, we haven't gotten to strict liability yet. Yeah.
The loss is much greater than what the cost of damage is. I understand that. But how can you take that and say, oh, yeah, that's a clear measure for why she should.
Well, it seems to me that it's by going through a mental process like this without actually putting the numbers up there. This number we do know, the one in 25,000, I'm just sort of throwing a number here that, let's say, it costs $5 to give every patient, not just those over 40, but every patient, it costs you $5 to give them this pressure test. All we need to find is that the saving of her vision is worth $125,000, which doesn't seem like an outrageous sum of money. If it's worth more than that, then a reasonable person would say, yeah, $5 per patient's worth it. So it's some kind of reasoning like that the court uses to arrive at the conclusion that the failure to give this test was negligent. Period, end of discussion. All we need to know is how much the damages are. Well, remember part of what we're doing a whole bunch of different things here. One of the things that we're doing is we're looking at the relationship of industry custom or professional standards here compared to the determination of whether somebody's exercised reasonable care. Back in the railroad case, we said, as a matter of law, if you're in compliance with industry custom, you are using reasonable care. But Learned Hand in the Hooper case says, no, courts in the end must say what is reasonable care. The issue, one of the issues in this case is, do we apply the same logic to tugboat operators that we do to ophthalmologists? Are ophthalmologists entitled to any greater deference in terms of accepting their judgment about the wisdom of using some practice or not compared to tugboat owners? Or do we simply take the practice of the profession with the same level of persuasive quality, but prepared to overrule it, that we would with respect to tugboat operators. And in the majority of the court says, yeah, tugboat operators, ophthalmologists, same. You might question the wisdom of that, but so it is. Now, we're still not to the point of comparing the majority opinion to the concurring opinion, because that's the place eventually we want to, at least I want to get, to try to figure out, okay, well, what's the difference between applying a negligence analysis, such as it is, compared to thinking about this case from the perspective of strict liability. So, Mr. Mucci, why don't you tell us about the concurring opinion? Okay. So one part of the opinion seems to be about the reluctance of the judge to impose the stigma of moral blame, that negligence in some way connotes a moral failing. And the judge says, I really don't think that applies in this case. I'm not prepared to say anything disrespectful about this particular doctor. And I would prefer a different disposition. Now, remember, though, that the concurring opinion is not dissenting from the outcome. The concurring opinion agrees with the majority on the issue of whether or not the doctor has to pay. In one sense, it would be more logical if the dissenting opinion said, if the concurring opinion were a dissenting opinion, said, we have no business saying that these doctors this particular doctor is at fault, and therefore he should not be held accountable. But they say, oh, in fact, he should be held accountable. We just don't want to put this label on him that says negligent. Okay, so far so good. But on what basis then can we reach around into his back pocket, pull out his wallet, take the money out of his wallet to pay for the plaintiff's injury, and say, didn't want to hurt your feelings here, didn't want to call you negligent, but after all, you do have to pay for this. On what basis does the doctor have to pay for it, according to the concurring opinion? I understand the concurring opinion is trying not to add insult to injury, not only take my money, but call me negligent to boot. But I prefer they didn't injure me at all by taking my money. Mr. Brown, what's your take on this? Hence, I begin this section of the book with this case, because now the judge is talking about strict liability. So what does that mean? Why are we imposing strict liability here? But I thought Learned Hand was helping us figure out when somebody was using reasonable care or not. He was saying that where you don't take a precaution that's relatively cheap in comparison to the expectation of injury, then you're acting negligently. I'm not sure I agree with you. This was our starting point in the concurring opinion, that the justices, and appears to be three of them, Utter writes it, and there are two others that sign on to it. Three out of the nine sign the concurring opinion, and they say, we don't want to call the doctor's behavior negligent. We don't think the doctor deserves to be called negligent. Yes, ma'am. Well, then that puzzles me. Well, I guess I'm puzzled about that they could have prevented it. I'm driving down the street. A little kid is running away from his playmates while they're waiting for the bus. He's not looking where he's going. He's looking over his shoulder. He runs out into the street right in front of me. I hit him, and he's horribly injured. Am I liable for that? Why not? Okay, but I didn't have enough time. I'm traveling the speed limit. The reason I wouldn't have to pay in that circumstance is that it's not my fault, right? I wasn't negligent. Profession. But is he, I stopped Mr. Brown, you know, from saying that everybody agrees they were negligent. I'm not sure it's clear what the concurring opinion is saying. One way of reading the concurring opinion is, well, he did good enough for the ophthalmology profession. Of course, he didn't do good enough for us. But for an ophthalmologist, it wasn't bad. Therefore, he doesn't deserve the name, the label negligent, but he really was negligent. We really do think that there was something he should have done that he didn't do. But there's another theme in the concurring opinion that doesn't seem to rely on a finding of negligence, either an overt finding of negligence, as the majority is willing to do, or a sort of backhanded, gee, for ophthalmologists it wasn't bad, but after all, they didn't go to law school, and we did, and we find this to be negligent. Ms. Riley. One way of understanding strict liability would be consistent with the next case, in the sense that you go into this profession carrying gasoline, practicing ophthalmology. Every once in a while, bad things happen. People get hurt. You stand to get rewards when things go well. You cure people in your ophthalmology practice. You collect the money. Fine. But every once in a while, something bad happens. A patient has a condition, isn't cured. Okay, those accidents you have to pay for regardless of whether you're at fault. We really aren't making a finding explicitly or behind your back that you were negligent. This isn't about negligence. It's about the fact that you chose to become an ophthalmologist and you take the bitter with the sweet. Is that what they're saying? I'm genuinely unsure here. Mr. Cafferty. Why not? Why can't they do that? Well, why do they think it's better that the doctor pays for it than that the plaintiff pay for it? Ms. McLaughlin? Okay. Yeah. That there. Now, this is different from what Ms. Riley was saying. I want to be clear that there is a rationale based on what Ms. Riley was saying that connects it to, say, this is like Siegler versus Kuhlman. This is a way of telling defendants, you go into one of these businesses, nobody held a gun to your head and said, you have to be an ophthalmologist. If you choose to do that, you take the bitter with the sweet. But that's different, I think, from the reason you just gave, a different form of strict liability, going back to our old friend Irving Younger, to say part of the function of the TORS system is this cost-spreading function. There's little Mrs. Bierman, there's the big city of New York. City of New York is better able to bear the loss than little Mrs. Bierman. So the ophthalmologist who's got a lucrative practice and lots of patients can spread the cost of the injury better than poor Mrs. Helling or Miss Helling or whatever her name is. Maybe they're saying that. Again, we're kind of groping around here to try to figure out which of the different things that they are saying is controlling and which things are sort of inconsistent with this. Now, let me just sort of test this last possibility. Are they saying that doctors will be subjected to strict liability where they are in a better position to spread the cost of the injury compared to their patients? If they, well, Mr. Caffrey, you're, well, let's test. We got our horses and our carts all over the place here. Let's test it with this hypothetical. Suppose you go to this, you know, the ophthalmologist. Suppose, first of all, we have to assume that the concurring opinion becomes the law. Two more justices read this opinion and say, gee, this is great. I want to sign on it. We now have a majority who agree with the reasoning, such as it is, in the concurring opinion. A doctor has a patient, ophthalmologist has a patient, comes in, has some kind of pain or discomfort, doctor x-rays it or examines it, discovers the patient has cancer. It's an inoperable kind of cancer. By the time the doctor looks at it, first time the patient is examined, by that time the cancer has metastasized into the brain. 3 months later, the patient's dead. Family of the patient sues the doctor on the strength of Helling versus Carey, now the majority opinion, and says, we've determined that we poor, you know, family of the patient need to have you, doctor, spread the cost of this injury by compensating us. First of all, do you think the people who wrote the concurring opinion would say, yep, that's right, patient recovers? No. Why not? What's different about that case? What's that? So what? Which means that he was. So that's what it's all about. Then here again, you know, this is where I want to clarify whether we are really saying to a doctor, don't go into ophthalmology unless you're prepared to pay for the unfortunate results, regardless of whether they're your fault, or whether when we get to the end of it, despite all this talk about strict liability, it's really all about negligence. If it's really all about negligence, then let's say so and don't use that phrase strict liability. If it's really about strict liability, then we should apply it wherever it applies. But it seems as though we're not really, it doesn't seem likely that the concurring opinion would want to impose a rule of strict liability either on the basis, I mean, first of all, let's think about those two bases for strict liability. One would be the one Ms. Riley suggested, apropos Siegler versus Kuhlman, in effect, you got into this business, it's your job to, you know, figure out a way to pay for it because you got to take the bitter with the sweet. What's illogical about that? Yeah. Well, but why would it also be illogical and seem like poor public policy? I wouldn't vote for that if I were in the legislature. Yeah. Right. I mean, at least no one would get into oncology. Maybe people would still do liposuction, you know, because there are enough paying customers to offset the ones that have bad results. But, you know, if you practice oncology and sick people walk into your door and you can only save a certain percentage of them and some of them die or, you know, have bad results, and if the implication is, well, it's your business, you got to pay for it, I would say, well, I'm not going to get into that business. And would we be the better for it? No, we wouldn't. Doctors didn't invent disease. This guy didn't invent glaucoma. It wasn't because he started practicing ophthalmology that people got glaucoma, which is very different from Siegler versus Kuhlman. In Siegler versus Kuhlman, we can say, if you didn't carry around 10,000 gallons of gasoline, we wouldn't have these, you know, Armageddon-type, conflagrations. We might have people, you know, stubbing their toes and, you know, getting run over by ox carts and so forth, but this particular kind of injury, getting burned by, you know, vaporizing gasoline, that only happens because people choose to carry around gasoline. So it really doesn't fit ophthalmology to say, in effect, you took this risk, you brought this thing into the world, now you bear the consequences, because they didn't. Mr. McElman. Well, and let me just isolate the problem of how scary it is that the court has, in effect, set aside the rules of the profession as the standard. So that before this opinion, I'm going along practicing medicine thinking the people whose opinion counts here are the people in my profession. And I got to read the literature and I got to stay up on what the latest techniques and stuff are so that I haven't fallen behind what people have decided is the way to handle all these different conditions. As of this opinion, I'm suddenly accountable not just to them, but what nine lawyers who put on black robes and sit up in the Supreme Court think, or what a bunch of jurors might think. Now they are my bosses too. And whether that's good public policy or bad public policy is for another day, in the sense that that all falls under the heading of how we determine whether somebody has acted negligently. For the moment, I'm still trying to identify what is the concurring opinion putting on the table in terms of a proposal. What are they offering us as a way to decide cases like this? One way is to say it's really about negligence, we're just too polite to call it that. Another way of saying it is that the doctors have taken a risk, and because they've taken a risk, they have to answer for the consequences of it. Another one that Ms. McLaughlin suggested was that it's all about cost spreading, and it's not so much that the doctor is taking a risk, it's that the doctor is better healed. Doctor has more resources, and we're doing a little bit of social redistribution here. It's unclear which of those three things the concurring opinion is really asking us to accept as the basis of liability. I would be rather nervous if it were either of the latter two forms of strict liability. That is, if three justices of the Washington Supreme Court seemed to think it was the doctor's fault, not fault, that it was the doctor's choice of entering into the practice of ophthalmology that caused people to get glaucoma, and therefore they need to belly up to the bar and answer for that. It would also be frightening to me if the justices of the Supreme Court thought that social redistribution or cost spreading on its own justified imposing liability on the doctor. I would be more comforted if I thought they were really talking about negligence, but were too polite to put it out in that way, and were really saying, and used the term strict liability in a misleading way that did not accurately reflect what they were really thinking. That's the most comforting. But I can't think of any other way to read this case. Mr. Hall? Well, this is where, with Ms. Riley, I wanted to kind of, you know, are you saying that when I drive down, I think it was you, when I drive down the street, are you saying that because I don't, no, I think it was Ms. Huckert, actually, whoever it was, if I'm driving down the street and the kid runs out in front of me and I smack into the kid, and you say, well, I could have prevented it by not driving that morning, or I could have prevented it by going slower, even though the speed limit was, I was within the speed limit, even though I wasn't negligent, I had the physical ability to do it. But then aren't we back to negligence again? If you're inserting a qualifier that says, I will only hold the doctor liable where he failed to do something I could reasonably expect of the doctor, then it seems to me you are talking about negligence. If, by contrast, you say the mere ability, and we could impose a standard on automobile drivers to say, in effect, you're liable for any injury you could have prevented by driving slower or by, you know, having some, you know, warning device on your car or a little kid catcher on it. You know, if you had, you know, if there was some way you could have prevented it, you're liable. Whether or not we find that you're negligent for failing to do that or not. But if the only cases in which you impose liability are where the defendant failed to do something that was reasonable, then it seems to me there's no, you've essentially eliminated the distance between that and the standard of negligence. Yeah. As far as the majority is concerned, they're indistinguishable. With the added thing, of course, that the court, instead of saying, we now return this to the jury, we rejoin your, you know, regularly scheduled programming here, the Supreme Court says, no. Well, we know the answer to that. No need to talk to the jury about this one. And again, looking at it as, you know, I have a brother who's a physician, and I get the impression that doctors have about lawyers, and cases like this don't help. You know, from the standpoint of saying, that the Supreme Court not only says, in effect, we will, in the end, decide how medicine is to be practiced, what is reasonable. If you fail to live up to our standards, we'll make you pay. That's jarring. I understand you guys decide what the discovery rules are and, you know, who qualifies as an expert witness and how you define this, that. These are the legal procedures. I understand all that. But, hey, in my field of medicine, at least, I get to decide whether to use this drug or that drug or when we do this test or that test. Radio. But the doctors, just so we understand how they feel, for what that's worth, the doctors say, excuse me, I'm not a tugboat operator here, you know. I went to medical school, and I understand a lot of stuff. And moreover, I have a set of ethics here. You know, the tugboat operators, I'm casting no aspersion on tugboat operators, but, you know, we are inculcated. This is a profession. It's not just a business. Now, again, one of the things that's very confusing in the world of medicine, as it is true in the world of law, is that we have this dual kind of identity. On some days, it's a profession, a noble calling, a vocation, and so forth. On other days, it's a business. I got a spreadsheet. I got a payroll to meet. I got, you know, loans to pay back. I got to make a living out of this. I got a bottom line. And doctors have been confused, shall we say, by the way in which cost has become a determinant of how we practice medicine. As it happens, my brother is a managed care guy. You know, he wears a green eye shade in addition to that little whatever that thing is in the sort of a classic icon. And so he's a proponent of cost control. And he doesn't trust doctors to simply write a blank check and say, you need this test, you need this test, you need this surgery, and so forth and so on. He thinks that somebody has to control how much doctors spend of your money. But, again, you can understand why a doctor would be somewhat frustrated with the idea of saying, is there no place left where you grant to me the kind of authority or deference? Lawyers decide what the legal procedures are. Lawyers decide how we practice medicine. There's something wrong with that picture, the doctor might say. I'd be perfectly happy, says the doctor, to tell you how the law should be written. And you can also see again why the doctors get their, you know, cudgels and go to the state legislature and say to their legislative representatives, this is what we want. And those nasty trial lawyers over there need to be taught a lesson. So again, this sort of, you know, professional comity, this, you know, polite relationship between the learned professions kind of dissolves into this turf war here. And it won't be the first time or the last time we'll see that. But again, I want to be clear about the way in which strict liability differs from negligence. Negligence is still about a determination that the defendant didn't live up to the standard of reasonable care. There are lots of different ways to get to that point, but that's the coin of the realm. Did you use reasonable care? Did you fail to use reasonable care? Strict liability, by contrast, says, as Rhett Butler said to Scarlett O'Hara, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That is, whether you were negligent or not doesn't matter to the determination of some forms of liability. But we have to be very clear about what it is. If it's not negligence that triggers liability, what is it? What is the basis for saying to the defendant, though you met the standard of reasonable care, though you were not negligent, you still have to pay for this? Why, the defendant is entitled to ask. And we have to be able to explain the answer, and that's what we'll try to do in Sigler versus Kuhlman. So we'll start with that on Monday. Yeah.